welcome.
Hi, Vinny.
Welcome. Yeah, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Leah Tress, I think. Leah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're here?
Okay, I work for an organisation called PANIC, Positive Answers Needed in Crisis. We started the organisation with the founder, Angie Rogerson, in 2010. It started with Angie having to go to the ministry against the panel due to her story with a little baby girl who was placed in an unsafe situation with a sex offender. Angela Rogerson had quite a battle on her hands, and it went all the way to the ministry, and she won her case. There was no support around for the Rogersons. They were left out of pocket at thousands of dollars. So Angie started PANIC. She's one of the founders. My job, I'm a client advocate. I've done about over 50 cases now. Yeah, that's just a little bit about it. Any questions? Oh, I can't hear you.
Basically, I've known of PANIC for quite a while. And I remember a conversation I had with a SIFS worker about a month back where we protested outside the SIFS office in Manurewa.
Oh, yes.
They were kind of the SIFS worker was attacking us, saying that not all SIFS workers are like this. And she went on to admit that she believes that SIFS is actually corrupt and run by corrupt people at the top who don't have any frontline experience. And what we'd both talked about was how to set up a new organization that does this job that Child, Youth and Family Service, or CIFS, is supposed to do, and actually support families and people, particularly those who have been failed by the system.
Yes.
And incidentally, that's what PANIC is really there
what
for.
We do. Yes.
So I'm acting under the assumption that no government money's coming towards you.
No.
You're getting no free press coverage. And also, you're probably being attacked and defamed by current people with power in some way, shape, or form.
You get really good social workers who know their job, and then you get ones who won't even talk to us. So it's across the board. We're not anti-SIFs. We just want to make sure that when it comes to children's lives, that the processes and social work practice going on is good and that families aren't going to be messed with. And that not all parents who have the 0508 family number called on them are bad parents. There seems to be a stigma around having SIFS involvement, where people think that where there's smoke, there's fire. And if your children are uplifted or taken from your care, that automatically bans you as a bad person, as a bad parent, that you can't parent your children. Sadly, that's not the case in some instances. A lot of the time, SIFs do get it right. But I've seen cases where they've gone and got it horribly wrong. I can't hear you again.
Sorry, I'm just having some trouble with my mute button. It's all my fault. I've always wondered this. What percentage of SIFS cases achieve a positive result and what percentage achieve a financial result?
Oh, as far as with going against the panel with
taking kids off, taking kids off parents, putting them in foster homes and so on and so forth, I believe there's a quota to be kept, a certain amount of Māori children, Pacific Islander, Asian, so on and so forth.
So we have heard of this. We have heard of this quota, yeah.
So they go out arbitrarily in order to snatch people's kids. That's the thing. If you've got a quota, it means that there's a financial incentive to take people's kids, whether or not those kids are actually, in fact, being abused.
We have asked the ministry if there is such a quota, and we're waiting for a reply on that through the Official Information Act. So it'll be interesting to see what their reply is.
Just how long you been waiting for that reply?
Think that because I've done.
Like it hasn't been like a week or something, has it? It's been quite.
No. I think it was in August. I think it's overdue. I think that one. So yeah, it's gone to the ombudsman. So I'm waiting. Yeah.
it's almost like you. I don't know. I don't know what to say in those particular situations because I assume the worst, you know, generally when we're talking about government departments and so on and so forth, you just assume the worst and 99% of the time you wind up being correct, unfortunately. 1% of the time you wind up being incorrect is like, oh, no, they're not doing that. Okay, sweetest. Thank God. Thank goodness. That's the thing about governments. I think the presumption of innocence should apply to individuals. The presumption of guilt should be applied to government.
Yes. And now it's completely reversed where Paula Bennett has brought in the you are now guilty until found innocent as far as with children being uplifted and child, youth and family are concerned now. So it makes our job even tougher, and we're getting more clients.
Well, I always – we do need to get some kind of support, community support for panic. This is the idea that I had, is that community groups and organizations, independent of the government, non-governmental organizations and so on and so forth, indeed need to get behind groups like panic because I believe that – when you have frontline staff who've had it with the system, who have the experience, who are very good at their job, who form their own organizations, something tells me that they are I guess the word is competition to the current government system, which means you'll be met with opposition. And perhaps it should be panic writing the child, youth and family services policies and panic training the social workers and so on and so forth. Wouldn't you agree, like in an ideal world?
Well, with our charity status, we can't have the whole activist aggression type thing. Their policies do need to change. Too many faults happen within their system where rogue social workers are given far too much power and being able to mess with families and uplift children when they shouldn't have been uplifted.
To what end? Do they get paid for doing this?
Yes. Yes, they do.
So they're stealing children for money?
If you want to put it like that, Vinny, then yes.
Okay. All right. I'm glad that we've got the nitty-gritty details sorted. All right. Okay. SIFS workers do actually steal children for money.
I'm not going to agree to that. I just the way it's put is terrible.
I think the worst way it's put, the more appropriate and the more accurate it is. I've talked to so many victims of the system, and it occurs to me that it's not isolated. It's
not at all.
Quite widespread, this abuse. Yes. And we have a instance of pedophilia infiltrating infiltrating into the organizations. Now, because these workers kind of almost have, they have greater powers than police, kind of thing.
They do, yes.
It can prevent them from being investigated for crimes to an extent, I should say. And on top of that, you have the family court, which the media is not allowed to report on. So if anything was going on, and we know that it is, not only would the police not be able to do anything about it because the workers outrank them, but the media wouldn't be able to report on it, so the public would never know, right? They've got it stitched up.
They do. They do. In that case, they do. But through the complaints process, it can go to the panel, which is and goes before the chief executive of the ministry.
How many people have ever gone before that due to complaints?
I don't actually have a number. I was looking at
anybody?
Yes. Yes, I know of a few. I had a client yesterday who was before the panel. Angela Rogerson, she's been before the panel and won her case and got an apology and compensation because of their mistake. Many children who were in the foster care but have now aged out of the foster care are going through historical claims and going to the panel due to the abuse that's happened while in foster care. And that's another thing. Foster care who are now parents who have aged out of the foster care have their massive target on their back that SIFs are almost, they're red flagged. Soon as they have a child, or before the child is even born, they have SIFs knocking on their door. I think it's a unfair disadvantage and that they should be supported instead of saying, you were in foster care, we'll take your child.
Sorry, I don't quite understand. What is it that you're saying here? People who are foster carers who have children themselves, real children take place at what?
No. So children that grew up in the foster care system who have aged out of the system and are now 19, 20, 21, early 20s, late, carry on, who become pregnant, automatically get red flagged by SIF. For being in that system. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. We see it quite often that if there's very little support, a young mum or having been a foster care child, that alerts, that puts up red flags and you become a target.
So there's many instances then, I would take it, of former Child, Youth and Family Services children having their children taken off them by SIFs.
Yes, I have clients myself. Yeah.
And this is a cyclic abuse, or is this simply being done arbitrarily without evidence?
There's
a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
Little bit of column A, little bit of column B, yes. Not without the right evidence or using the fact that they were in the foster care system and had things done to them to say, well, you're not fit to be a parent. Yeah.
So we take you from your parents, we abuse you, and then after you've grown up so that we can't control you anymore, as soon as you start to have your own family, then we come straight back into your life.
Yes.
Yeah. That sounds about right, doesn't it?
Sounds about right.
No, I don't like the situation here. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
Alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder incorporated organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly sneak parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein controls, these hangman rope sneak deadly gangsters, the judges and the police trick, trap, rob, wreck, butcher, and murder the people to keep them terrorized.
Welcome back.
Hi.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about computer-odd communism. And my very special guest is Leah Trass from Panic. Can I ask you, Leah, you look real young. How long have you been doing this?
Oh, I only started early this year, like last year.
Yeah. So it doesn't take a very long time to realise the corruption in the system, I'd say.
No, rose-coloured glasses are off.
Yeah. Can I ask you what kind of clicked you on to what's wrong with this picture?
So what actually happened was I split with my ex and he rung the 0508 family number on me. I had Sif's knock at my door and investigate me. The case, I never heard from them again. I never saw them again, but I had it worried me that anybody can ring that number. Any malicious allegations can be made against you when you're a parent. Annoy the neighbour. That friend you had a dispute with, they can say, well, you know what, I'm going to get back at my friend and I'm going to ring that 0508 family number. And it's seen to be used as a weapon. And that's how I found Panic. Because I found Lee Bailey, who was also a founder of Panic. She is now retired due to health concerns. And she started talking to me about Panic and what they did and how they are a support advocacy group and help obtain SIF files to see where the investigation is going, help finding lawyers, preparing you for family group conferences, going to meetings with you and going to the FGCs with you, and just emotional support, because it is so stressful when you pretty much have a microscope on your parenting. It was not a fun experience for me, but luckily, I had a very supportive and core network as far as family and friends around me, and Sif were able to see that and so close that file. Although with files, they stay on their computer system for life, so my name and the allegations I've had made against me stay on that computer forever. There's just a note that says no concerns or whatever's on there. which is also worrying in the fact that we have seen a number of cases where SIFs have come once or twice. There has been the no concerns bracket put around and noted on their file, but then future concerns, and they've gone back and used those concerns that were noted on the file against that person. So they can come back to bite you, sadly, even if they are deemed malicious.
And do they require any evidence?
As far as making the allegations and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and allegations made, do they require any actual evidence before they take your kids?
It depends.
Like legally, do they have to go into a court and say, we've got this photo, we've got this video, they're abusing their child? Oh, okay, well, we'll just get the thing. Or is it just on the social worker's word?
No, what happens usually, it depends on the allegations. Usually court follows an uplift. Yeah. There's not usually, or not in the experience that I've had, where...
Are we talking about a real court or a eugenics court, otherwise known as the family court?
Family court.
Okay, because that one's completely controlled and stitched up and so on and so forth, as far as my research has led me to believe.
Okay.
So if they do want to lie, let's assume worst case scenario. Father has a child taken from him for absolutely no reason, and the social worker lies about it, and it's in the family court. He can't report it. He has to pay for his own lawyer. He can't afford it, and so he loses his kid for absolutely no reason on made-up allegations. Has that happened before?
Where a social worker has lied in court?
Yeah.
Yes, it's happened.
Yeah. Do you have any examples of that? Or?
Can't breach confidentiality.
See, there you go. There's the inherent problem in the system. You can't actually expose somebody for telling lies because of confidentiality.
Well, I don't want to also breach a client or a victim's confidentiality either. Yeah, that's what it comes down to.
But of course, if you don't mention their names and if you simply mention the stuff, there's nothing specific to tie them back to it, is there?
No, as long as there's no identifying factors. But yes, I have in one case, they didn't even notify the family that there was actually a court proceeding, so they couldn't even attend and defend their case. So it was stitched up basically right from the get-go. But there still is a need for an agency like Child, Youth and Family. Child abuse does happen. And I don't want this interview...
Oh, well, this is the argument. This is the argument. And let's say, top of my head, 10% of current child, youth and family workers are corrupt. Pedophiles, okay. or so on, yep. And so forth. Let's just assume that.
We'll go with that.
But should we then say that because 90% of them are doing a good job and preventing abuse, that we should let the 10% of pedophiles and corrupt social workers get away with it?
No, not at all.
See,
not at all.
That's the problem with the system and the way it's set up now is that those 90% of good people become the public face, and those 10% of bad people. This is, of course, a made up thing, by the way. Basically, more or less, get immunity to a large degree and continue to operate.
Yes. Well.
So let's say, for instance, you simply have a investigation organization. You grant the ability to actually look into these files, see which of the workers are in fact corrupt or pedophiles or whichever kind of a form of scumbaggery they tend to be committing, and they can be investigated, they can be fired. right? That's what I'd like, is just to leave the system as it is, except cut out the cancerous lesions that are eating away at its core.
Agreed. What we at Panic have seen, though, is where the poor social work practice happens and a restructuring of different branches, they actually shift the social workers to a different branch. So it just, yeah.
So that means that there is an endemic protection. That means that somebody at the highest levels is, in fact, involved. It's the only way that those kind of organizations can get away with committing crimes for certain periods of time and covering up and allowing people like that to keep working for them is if there's somebody at the top covering it up.
Maybe. Who knows?
It's a hierarchical structure. Nothing happens in a hierarchical structure without those at the top of the hierarchy willing it so. So who's at the top saying pedophiles are okay, child abuse is okay, corruption is okay, and we're going to protect those people? Is it because those people know that the system's corrupt and they can turncoat, perhaps, reveal evidence if they were ever to actually suffer consequence for their actions, this kind of thing? And again, a reminder to the audience, we're talking about a very small minority of SIFS workers. Any conspiracy, and let's define conspiracy, it's two or more people coming to harm another group of people without that group of people actually being aware of it.
Yeah, and that's,
in which case, fits the definition.
Yes. One thing that Panic are finding is that not a lot of people know their rights when it comes to parents. What on earth is guardianship and their rights as a guardian? And also knowing how they can get their SIFS files, what they're entitled to know and what they're not entitled to know. There's just this massive grey area and confusion when dealing with SIFS because they don't get told, which is where Panic comes in. And we try to guide our clients and get some clear understanding and help obtain the files and try and work with them and support them, whether it's doing parenting courses or just eliminating those SIFS concerns. And if we can do that and work towards a transition home or just supporting the supervised access or the access that is needed with the parents if the child cannot be returned home because of neglect or abuse.
So if people have been failed by the system, they go to Panic. Panic helps, and that's basically what they're there for, is when the system fails, right?
Correct. That's what we're here for. We are the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff.
Well, so wouldn't Panic want to be working in tandem with SIFS as kind of like a contracting agency of some description? Like, for example, the GCSB building, in Wellington has offices of the NSA in it, you know? Maybe Panic... A lot of people don't know that. Maybe Panic should have an office in every SIFS office.
Now that would be a laugh.
it would be classic, wouldn't it?
Oh, dear Lord.
you're like, welcome to SIFS. If you think that we're corrupt or we're not mishandled, there's the office over there that you can go to. Those people will expose our corruption and help you, actually.
That would be insane, Vinny. Oh, God.
it's like the US military having a Taliban office on base or something, you know.
it wouldn't work. But what we are hoping to do is to almost work with SIFS to pick up their flaws. But we are independent of SIFS. To an extent. I mean, Angela Rogerson, who is the founder, She was a SIF caregiver for 27 years. We have about just over 20 in our team, in our panic team, who help as many people as we can. At the end of the day, it is about the children. Not discriminating against people just because they have a disability. A couple of cases I'm dealing with right now.
Yeah. Well, it's an emotionally traumatic employment opportunity, as far as I know. It's getting to the point where the SIF counsellors need SIF counsellors themselves, because to see the overarching human suffering element that you get exposed to just hearing these stories, not even seeing it, is enough to emotionally traumatize people. That's also one of the other things that's very, very difficult to deal with as a SIFS worker, to my knowledge. You're supposed to be the support worker for other people, but the job's so harsh that you wind up needing your own support worker and that kind of thing. It's like almost like you have to pass the emotional buck in some way. I believe that situation may have led many SIFS workers to turn it off. Turn off what's up here, turn off what's down in here in their heart so that they can just deal with it. And in so doing, they lose the ability to actually help the people that they're employed to help, because they do not have the feeling and they can't take it anymore. We'll be right back after the break at the Vince Show.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president, it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, but world's so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go frickin' nuts. And my very special guest from Panic is Leah Trask. Now, Leah, what is Panic's website there?
www.panic.org.nz.
Panic.org.nz. It's pretty easy to remember, because when your children are taken away from you and you're dealing with corrupt scum, you kind of start to panic a little bit, you know? It's just like, oh, my God, I'm panicking. Hey, who can help me? Panic! You know, I think that's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
It's pretty straightforward. And we have an online magazine now where there are a range of tips for families and also caregivers. Caregivers are more than welcome on our Facebook page as well. Parents, families, caregivers. We don't turn anybody away as such. Mm. Yeah.
How long has Panic actually been running for?
It started in 2010, Positive Answers Needed in Crisis. There was an old Panic, Parents Against Negative Intervention by SIFs. But that was more an extremist activist type group, and we have a charity status, so we're hoping to gain some funding soon. We don't have any as of yet. So
they have a donate button or a PayPal account or a bank account that people can...
We do have a bank account. It is on our website, and it's also on our Facebook page. All you need to do on Facebook is just type it into the search and Positive Arts Needed in Crisis, and we should pop up. And so any donations. We also have a Give a Little on the Give a Little website. We're also set up there because we just became a charity in July of this year. We got our charity status. So that's pretty exciting, and things are moving forward at a great rate. Gaining about 100 members within about a 3 to 4 week period at the moment. Things are getting pretty full on as far as panic is concerned. Yeah.
Do we have an end game? So let's say, for example, you've got a government organization called SIFS, which does a lot of good work. But some of the things that fall through the cracks, on and so forth, you want pretty much all of those people who actually are having problems with endemic corruption, deception, so on and so forth, abuse and what have you, on the behalf of percentage or whatever it is of CIS workers that aren't acting in the children's best interest, all of those victims should go panic's way in order to not help them with their situation, but also to expose those CIFS workers that are not doing a good job.
Yeah, and for them to be held accountable, yes.
How can they be held accountable by a charity organisation, though?
Because we are an organisation and not just one person, when it comes to... we can do agent forms, and through the complaints process, we can actually make a complaint on behalf of that one client. So it's not just one client or one person dealing with CIFS. It's a whole organisation that is behind them, and it has more standing. Yeah.
So can you tell me some success stories?
Leave
on a positive note, you know?
Okay. I'm just trying to pick one. That's quite a good one.
Have there been any particularly nasty abusers within CIFS that have gone to jail, perhaps, as a result of panic's investigations?
Jail? No. No jail time. As far as abuse, no jail time, no. I haven't seen it in dealing with the close to 50 cases I've dealt with, but I've had some really good successes. One where a couple had two children. He was abusive. Sif said something needs to change here, and we're going to put your kids with the parents, with the parents of those parents, so go with grandparents. The mother ended up leaving him, getting into domestic violence programs, started studying, also did parenting courses, and then moved away from her abuser and now is going for day-to-day care of her children. But she just about lost them through a FGC. Yeah.
Now, it occurs to me that the trauma trauma teaches people a lot of very important lessons. And I know a lot of CIFS activists, the only reason why they are activists is because they've experienced an awful lot.
A lot of hurt and anger there, yes, with the activists, yes. Yeah, I would agree. Massive.
They need to be the ones who are protected, I feel. They're the ones that need to be supported to a large degree because they do the job that, say, an organization like Panic can't do. Panic is about helping people.
Yes.
The activists are about exposing the thing that is, in fact, doing harm to those people, right? So there's a relationship there, a very healthy, I believe, working professional relationship between the activists and the people at Panic. As a result, though, because Panic has that that involvement with activists, it would mean that many ignorant people will use that as a weapon to demonize Panic and say, oh, you're involved with all of these crazy people with the megaphones and so on and so forth. And that really frustrates me to a large degree.
Speech.
Yeah.
It's freedom of speech. None of our team are activists, nor is it a view of Panic to be an activist. But we do have a few on the page who express their views, and they should be allowed to do that if that's what. There's a lot of hurt and anger that comes from, and that's their way of expressing it. Because they feel they've been done wrong by CIF or by government in general. Yeah.
Mm. So just imagine for a moment, ladies and gentlemen, if you could close your eyes for a second. You got a beautiful child. You know, you've fed them, you've clothed them, and then some scumbag comes along, says some malicious lies, steals your child, and you haven't seen them for 7 years. Think about that. And you wonder, what kind of out do you have from that kind of thing? Counselling ain't going to help you. Your kid back, because you still don't have your kid back, you know? That's the real problem here. We're dealing with an almost unfixable situation. What is it that makes that situation unfixable? The corruption in the system. The inability to have accountability, in other words. That's the real problem, is that the only reason why society's in trouble is because laws are selectively enforced. You know, ultimately, if the same law applied to everybody and it was enforced equally, we wouldn't have any problems like this whatsoever, no. Would we?
No, but human error is what it comes down to, I think, a lot of the time. People make mistakes.
I do. Okay. Leah Trass, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today and sharing the information that you've got there. Panic.org.nz. Panic.org.nz is the website, ladies and gentlemen. I encourage you to donate to this organization. It's now an official, so you know, because it's a registered charity, that, hey, the money ain't just going into somebody's pocket. It's actually going to really help people. And I think that's something we should all be very proud of. Thank you very much, Leah, for the work that you do.
Thank you, Vinny.
See you again sometime. All right, ladies and gentlemen, coming up next, Ben Emlyn Jones, I believe. Let's go anywhere, folks. Disinformation to fed, check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we've got a little bit of an echo, bro. I think it might be from Ben Emlyn-Jones, my very special guest. Ben, welcome to the program. Ben, are you there? Can't hear him, mate.
Oh, hello. Hello, Vinnie. How are you?
Oh, now I got you. Good on you,
sorry,
mate.
Sorry, mate. My microphone's muted. Sorry.
It's all good. All us professionals like to mute and then talk while it's still muted.
Yeah, I know it happens to everyone, doesn't it? I mean, I thought I could hear the music and I thought I don't want to talk over that, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I was doing that the first segment, you know, I think it happened twice in the first segment where I had my mic muted and started to talk. And she's like, I can't hear. It's like, oh, my God, I'm such an idiot. I should have this thing locked down. It's been like 3 years on talk radio, Vinny. You've got to get your Shiite Muslim together.
I'm a radio show host too, and I you know, we all make these cock ups, don't we?
Yeah. Well, I mean, cock ups is part of the game. That's why we're radio show hosts.
Yeah, it's just if we can have a laugh at them, laugh about them afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, we're useless in the other form of employment.
Well, why else are we doing this? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Radio is the last refuge for those who just can't get a real job.
Exactly. Either that, or they make you a manager. They put you in management, and I was either get made a manager, or you get sacked and become a radio show host.
Yeah, something like that. I presume you were a manager back in the day too. You know,
oh,
I was a business account manager for a short period of time, but then they paid me $3,000 to leave because I was exposing what was wrong with the company.
Well, that sounds like a good deal to me, Vinny. I tell you.
I hadn't had a summer holiday in a long time. I took the money around. Yeah. Sorry, what?
Yeah. I was going to say, no, I'm quite proud to say I was a basic grade hospital porter for my entire career, and I was never offered promotion, and only the real horrible people got offered promotion, so I must have been doing something right. I consider it a compliment.
Yeah. Isn't that the real freaking sad thing about our world? You know? It's just... That F's me off to no end. It's if you're a sociopathic scumbag who sabotages your competition in the company, you rise right to the top. Kind of like scum on a pond.
Exactly. I mean, it was the people who were really, really useless at their jobs and were always kissing the bottom of the bosses, and they were always really horrible people. And they'd be in the office in no time. You always knew them. You could spot them as soon as they joined up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they protrude this aura of, I'm better than you. I don't really care about anything but myself. Oh, well, mate, he must be getting up in management. Why is that? Well, so we can fire people and not give a frack that he destroyed their entire livelihood and their family. Okay. Oh, wait. Who else had something like that? Oh, yeah. The Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, has, what was it? I met a girl at a party, and her father used to work with John Key on Wall Street, and he fired 200 people in one day.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, okay, so he had to tell 200 people, one by one, you're out of the job, you won't be able to feed your family. There's no separation passage. There's no golden handshake or parachute. You'll basically have to start your life over again.
Do you know they enjoy
it? He was smiling the whole way through it, and that's how he got his nickname, the Smiling Assassin.
Yeah, they enjoy it. See, this is how the system always knows there's enough people. There's just enough people. I don't know. People say it's 6% or whatever of psychopaths. Laura Nijadzic,
4% is what I've heard.
Yeah, I mean it varies. Some people say it's more, but Laura Nijadzic says it's 6%. Santos Bonacci says it's so much. I don't know whatever the figures are. It's a minority.
Who cares?
Of people. Yeah,
they're there.
It's enough.
That's undeniable.
Yeah, the system knows. The system has enough. It doesn't matter what the percentage is. It is a minority of people, but you only need a minority. You only need a minority of people who have no conscience, who are willing to do these things without any feeling, and that's enough to maintain the system.
Yeah, pretty much. Because you just put those people in key positions to prevent investigations. Or to demonize an attack and destroy anybody who's trying to conduct one.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. I mean, I've encountered these people many times.
Yeah, it's kind of unavoidable. In particular, our line of work, exposing scumbaggery, it's kind of like our bread and butter. I mean, look at it this way. Without scumbaggery, we wouldn't have a job. So I'm actually kind of grateful in a way. Oh. You know? I mean, it's an employment opportunity, you know.
You've got to look on the bright side, haven't you? But I'd be happy to go and do something if necessary, you know. It's like David Icke said. He says, would you want to do something? As John Ronson said, would you want to do something else with your life apart from this? And he says, my God, yes. I go back into sport. I do sport presenting again any day.
Yeah. It's just, unfortunately, there's bigger problems afoot than finding the top scorer.
That's it. I mean, this is something I've dedicated my life to now, and I can't go back now.
Yeah, I'd be making films and stuff like that, and writing and directing plays, and doing a whole lot of really creative things with my life if this hadn't happened to me. That's the unfortunate business, is that you kind of give up your dream to a large degree, and you have to almost come up with a new one because the other one becomes irrelevant.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I always wanted to be a successful writer. I mean, I'm a writer. I've written a couple of books, not sold that many. I've really been trying to work on another book, and it's just I don't have time because there's too much going on in the real world to deal with. I mean, since I lost my job, I was a hospital porter, like I said, and I actually lost my job in very suspicious circumstances. It looks like someone very important told them to get rid of me, put it that way.
What is a hospital porter? I've never heard of that job description before, but forgive my ignorance.
It's all right. I mean, they go by different names in different countries. I mean, like, orderly is another word for it.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, orderly, do you have that? Is that what we have in New Zealand? Basically, the guys who...
Except in New Zealand, they're not that good. They're more like disorderly.
Yeah, that's a brilliant film, that is. Oh, I love that film because it's the only one that portrays us in a positive light. All the other films and TV shows patronise us and make us look really downtrodden and everything. Like, oh. Basically, we're the guys who move people around in wheelchairs and on beds. We move equipment, we move rubbish, we move drugs, we move blood for transfusions, almost anything to anywhere. It's basically logistics. That's the porter's job in a hospital. All large hospitals have porters, and it's the job I did. I did it for many, many years, and I was very, very proud to be a porter. I mean, there's no room for false modesty. I mean, I was a member of an elite. I was by far the most dedicated, most experienced, most highly trained member of staff they had. But they got rid of me. They got rid of me without a second's hesitation, in very suspicious circumstances, because it was just, I'd been interviewed by some newspapers, you see, and because I have a blog called Hospital Porters Against the New World Order, a PANWO. And it's I do YouTube videos as well, and of course CMR with a radio show. And I was very, very, very strange thing happened because I was doing this for years. I started in 2006, actually, and I was quite outspoken at work. I never made any secret about what I was doing, but they suddenly called me into the office one day, and they say, Ben, we're suspending you because some of the material you've been putting on your blog is inappropriate, and it's offensive, and it brings the hospital into disrepute because you keep going on about hospital porters all the time. We don't like that. And I said, well, how long? I've been doing this for ages. You know I've been doing this. Why are you suddenly complaining now? And they said, well, we've just happened to have received a complaint. And I thought, hey, male cow excrement. What happened was, 2 weeks before all this kicked off, I was interviewed in the newspapers. That's what it was all about. I mean, that's not a coincidence, Vinny. I don't believe in coincidences like that.
I believe in coincidence. Just, rarely. You know, on occasion, coincidences do happen. Sometimes. People tell me, oh, Vinny, you think everything is a conspiracy. It's, no, not everything. Just most things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, but it just seemed a little bit too convenient. Sometimes something happens, you think that's too... And also, I'm not the only guy who's suffered like this. I mean, there's people like Tony Farrell in England and Kevin Annett in Canada and Gary Heseltine, another English guy, be policeman. They've all got into trouble at work through their interest in these subjects, all of them. And it's really... It's a very, very... Not a good career move, Vinny. It's not a good career move at all to get involved in conspiratorial matters.
You know, actually, I think you might be right there to a large degree. There's very few people who are actually capable of making a decent living out of exposing scumbaggery. You know, possibly think of a few names who've actually made a decent amount of coin off of it and are getting a decent apparatus going and what have you. But the vast majority of people in our position are honest, decent, hardworking people for whom money is not the objective. And in fact, for the most of the part, just live off the bones of our ass and do what we can to expose the New World Order. That's it.
Exactly. I mean, I can't believe the skeptics who say that this is some kind of big industry. They say, oh, it's a cottage industry. These guys are making a fortune. They've never, ever, ever seen what we do, what we get up to, what the kind of lives we lead. I mean, it's ridiculous. I went to a skeptic conference once because I like to hear both sides of every story. And it's the most upmarket thing you can imagine. It took place at the London Metropole Hilton Hotel. And it was all velvet chairs, free food, free coffee. Oh, yes, it was very opulent indeed. And there was a big merchandise hall full of tea, full of DVDs, full of books, full of all kinds of things that the skeptics like to think that we're out to sell. Well, they are too. So they're hypocrites, complete hypocrites.
Mm. Well, I haven't really even bothered trying to get advertisers or anything like that. Like even the one of the main kind of ads that I have is for Blue Shield, and I haven't sold any of those in like nearly a year, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking of like pulling it all off because it's my listeners. That's what's interesting. People like you and I are good, decent people, and so are the people that listen to us, the people that choose to listen to us. And so I found whenever I ask for help from my listeners, financially speaking, I almost always receive exactly what I need in order to just keep continuing to do what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that, I'm really intensely grateful for that ability so that I don't have to go get a slave job, that I can spend 16 hours a day working and exposing scumbaggery. And I really appreciate the fact that I'm even able to do that because it's not me that made that happen. It's actually the listeners.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. I mean, we at CMR, we're always very grateful for the same thing because people do help us out. I mean, we tried to advertise for a while. It didn't pan out. So basically, we also keep the station going through donations. And anyone who donates, we're very, very grateful. Absolutely. We really, really do appreciate it.
Yeah. And it's almost like the point where you don't even, where the word being grateful, having appreciation, doesn't quite cut it with the with the description. You know what I'm saying? Like there's a far larger game at work here. There's this almost like it's spiritual in a way.
Oh, very much so, yes, in many ways.
Yeah. I mean, for my part, I mean, I look at the statistics of who listens and to my show or watches it on YouTube. And what's interesting, I'm 28, and the vast majority, I think around about 85% of my listeners are between 45 and 65.
Oh, so nice.
Most of the people that listen to me are old enough to be my parents. And to a large degree, that's actually how I feel kind of like I'm trying to honor them, you know, how you try to honor your parents and so on and so forth. And maybe it's both ways. Like I'm the little incorrigible son, surrogate son to a large degree.
I don't know. Maybe that's how they see you. Yeah, maybe it could be that's how they see you. But that's good. I mean, obviously, maybe they're people who sort of like been through most of their lives into middle age and they've not really questioned anything. And then suddenly, you know, it just hits them one day. These things can happen at any time in our lives.
Yeah. Well, either that or they've gone through their entire life knowing what they know and had a real difficult time with it. I mean, knowing that there's a bunch of ruthless criminals, sociopathic scumbaggery, pedophile, Satanist filth running the world, running your country, enslaving your people, is not a nice fuzzy feeling.
It's not the kind of thing that makes you sleep easy in your bed. That's true.
No. And so I feel that what my role is to help people, you know, deal with it and have a laugh here or there, release the tension, that kind of thing. I mean, I may not take it too seriously, but at the end of the day, there are a shockingly large amount of people out there on radio who do take it very, very seriously. But not too many people who don't, who help you to actually deal with the seriousness of the situation. That's, I feel like, kind of my niche. Because, we've been through it, Ben. You know? We've experienced the trauma. Have you like, yelled at relatives and so on and so forth because you're just so angry at the New World Order and you feel that your relatives are slaves and so on and so forth? I have. I'm sure many.
Yes. I haven't, and they think I'm crazy. My parents do, my daughter does, and it's I've given up doing that now. We tend to just sort of, like, leave each other alone, but we can get on all right. But, I mean, it's true. I mean, if you don't let your hair down, if you don't have a laugh at it, it can destroy you psychologically. I mean, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said that life is too important to be taken seriously, and I rather endorse that. I think it can become depressing, actually, because, as you said, it's so, the list of all the things you just said about our leaders is true, and they're getting away with it. At the same time, I feel encouragement, because there was recently an opinion poll in the United States which showed that a very surprisingly large proportion of Americans are conspiratorially aware. Obviously, most of them are not as vocal as we are. In fact, the majority must be keeping, you know, be kind of closet conspiracy theorists that haven't come out to their family and friends, you know. Hi, my name's Ben and I'm a conspiracy theorist, you know, anything like that, you know. So they're obviously just, I mean, I'm, so in a way, the spreading of information is halfway to being achieved. The big challenge now is encouraging those people to sort of, like, speak out and do something, take action on their knowledge and go out, tell their friends and things like that. I mean, do you know?
Hold on, we're coming to break. We're coming to break now, Ben. That'd be a great group to have, you know, Conspiracy Theorists Anonymous. Hi, my name's Vinny, and I'm a conspiracy theorist. We'll be right doing back, company, ladies, gentlemen.
We're here to take care of you, Vinny.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the Godfather-inspired program where we expose scumbaggery and people that grow cocaine in the Baron Rothschild's home back garden. With a very special guest, it's Ben Emmeline Jones coming aside from the Uber Kingdom. Welcome back.
Hello, Vinnie. Cool. That voice is scary, man.
Yeah, it is a little. I don't know. I think it's a cool voice, though, you know? Marlon Brando really, he sort of embodied everything that it really took to be a Don. You know what I'm saying?
No, you just hear sunglasses, violin case, that kind of, I want to put you in my car boot kind of voice, you know?
Yeah, it's like a Don of a new age.
Yeah, fantastic actor.
Mm.
Really brilliant.
Now, speaking of fantastic accents, I was thinking about how funny particular accents can be. And I've come up with this. There's Irish accent, Cockney accent, and South African. I think that these are the three most hilarious accents, particularly, you know, joking around and so forth. It's just brilliant. It occurs to me that the New Zealand accent is very odd and weird for some people. You know, there's only a couple million of us around the world, right? And because we all speak English, thanks to the British Empire, we can still understand each other to a large degree.
God
Americans,
save the Queen.
On the other hand, it's I've noticed that there's a great difference between American English and New Zealand English and English English and Australian English and so on and so forth. And it seems that the Americans are the most isolated linguistically in terms of accents than any other nation in the world, because it's all American. It's all American this, it's all American that. There's California accents, New York accents, Texas accents, so on and so forth. And it comes to the point where, interestingly enough, even though I'm speaking English, they don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, I mean, I love it when New Zealanders pronounce my name, because I'm always Bean Emeline Jones, and I'm like, Bean. Everybody calls, keeps calling me Bean. But the United States, I guess, is quite geographically isolated. I mean, it's thousands of miles from almost anywhere except Canada and Mexico.
Mm.
And I think it's obviously it's culturally ever since the Masonic Revolution, it's kind of developed. It's been turned into this superpower, and it's become very dominant in terms of global culture. I mean, maybe that's changing now because I think they're building China up to take its place now. But I noticed the Americans, they go all across Europe and they expect everyone to speak English. And they're nice people, you know, but they're very insular and they're very naive. They don't really understand the kind of cultures they get to in Europe. You can go almost within an hour's drive and you enter another area where they speak a different language. You don't get that in the United States.
No. Except in Chinatown.
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. I mean, what we were saying before the break, though, about Americans, about the levels of conspiratorial awareness, according to this poll, it's a very, very interesting opinion poll, ever since the Kennedy assassination, which will be 50 years ago next month, I think a majority of Americans have always disbelieved the official story. They've disbelieved that Oswald was the shooter, the only shooter, and or the shooter at all. This year, I think it's 52% of Americans question it, which is really, really good. 52% of Americans, when asked, do you believe this official story of the Kennedy assassination, the Warren Commission, the Oswald with the single rifle, and they say no.
Yeah, that's encouraging. You'd have to be crazy or have seen none of the evidence in order to believe it, you know. And this is actually, I think, one of the keys of insanity. What was his name? Einstein said that insanity was repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting to get a different result. My definition of insanity is listening to and believing liars over and over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah, it's like, oh no, this time they're telling us the truth. Honest, it's true. I mean, they'll change. I know they can change. We're almost like, I think we're almost like battered wives in a way, you know.
It's Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
Where's the international court? Isn't it in Stockholm as well? International Criminal Court in The Hague or what?
It's in The Hague, yeah. It's in The Hague in the Netherlands. But it would be a sort of like quite appropriate joke if they moved it to Stockholm, actually.
It would actually be pretty funny. I believe there is something in Stockholm that's like really important that's related to that. I just can't remember the name of the organization or the institution that it is. But it occurs to me that we're dealing with an epidemic of global Stockholm syndrome. People just love to be captive. They love to be in the employ of the people that are trying to destroy their life. Isn't that strange? Right? And it's yeah. Because they don't even know. They don't even have any idea. They haven't had an inkling yet. And it takes being messed around by the system, like big time messed around by the system, before you wake up to it. And they go, oh my God, these people who were telling me that the organization I was working for was corrupt and full of scumbaggery and so on and so forth, they were right the whole time. Oh my God, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do? And you get lost, right? Because your entire perception of reality just...
Yeah.
Pitters out and disappears, and it's back to square one. It's like, let's say you lived until the age of 40 years old, give or take. You have an entire life. You've had careers, you've had businesses, you've had children, and so on and so forth. Then you get hit with acute Alzheimer's or just acute amnesia, and then suddenly you don't know anything. And everything that you'd ever learned throughout the entirety of your existence, every feeling you've ever felt, every dollar you've ever spent, suddenly fades out and disappears. And you're back to square one. That's really scary and traumatic because you don't even know who you are, let alone what the hell everything else is.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been there. I mean, I know what it feels like to believe. I mean, I remember quite clearly voting for Tony Blair. Please, yes, listeners, I'm not proud of myself. I voted for Tony Blair when one election. And I remember thinking, he seems a really nice man. I think he can really lead this country into something new and better, I remember thinking. And then I look back now and I think to myself, well, why did I feel like... I find it hard to actually remember. I mean, I have periods of missing time in my life. There's a medical reason for that. But I remember thinking to myself...
What's that medical reason?
Oh, well, I'll send you the notes over and you can publish them on the blog. Put them in the show notes, mate, yeah.
Unless you don't want to, you know.
Oh, it's a private, personal thing. It is a bit, yeah, but it's basically, all it's, right. It's...
Moving on.
I know what you mean, but it's funny because, I mean, things sort of creeped up on me in the course of my life because, I mean, I was a hospital porter. I was on night shift the night Diana died.
Wow.
On the 31st of August 1997 or 98, whenever it was. And I remember, I mean, it was quite a shock, actually, because I thought a poor woman's had a car accident. And then I remember the doctors, because we all crowded around the TV set to watch it. We were all of us on duty. Luckily, it wasn't very busy, and we could crowd around the TV set. And the doctors, these are trained emergency department officers, they were, and the nurses who were years of experience, they kept saying, why is she still in the tunnel? Why haven't they moved her? How long has she been in there now? And then we got a phone call through from someone at the Department of Health telling us to go out and put the flag down, the hospital flag down to half mast. And we did that. And then 20 minutes later, they announced she was dead. And I remember thinking to myself, that's not an accident. And I wasn't the only one that night thinking that.
Yeah. The Diana case is a real suspicious one. It was like
extremely.
14 CCTV cameras that covered their route from the hotel that they were leaving. The statistical likelihood for any one of them to fail is pretty low.
Mm.
The statistical likelihood of 14 of them all simultaneously failing is impossible. Like, well, almost impossible, right? Like a 1 in a billion chance for that to happen by sheer coincidence.
Oh, absolutely. To the point, I mean,
it's just total BS. And what I found one of the most interesting things, there's my two favorite facts about the Diana assassination. One is the CCTV cameras, and the second is the paparazzo who allegedly caused their car to crash, burning himself to death in a car, committing suicide, and being the first person in European history to have ever committed suicide by burning themselves to death in a car.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. I mean, if the idea that they could catch this big, fast Mercedes on scooters is ridiculous for a start. Secondly, there was a coroner's inquest in 2007 in London, which was because of a complete whitewash. I mean, Keith Allen, the filmmaker, he's made a movie about it called Unlawful Killing, and it's banned in Britain. You can't illegally watch it in Britain. I mean, there's a few. I really do encourage listeners not to go to Google and put it in and look for a bootleg site to watch it. It's basically shows that the whole coroner's inquest was a whitewash. And now, some newspapers are actually publishing some revelations by people in special forces and their families who are coming out and saying that there was a conspiracy within the special forces. Now, obviously, this is very suspicious. You'd think there'd be a full investigation. At the moment, it is in the media, which is something. But this could be the first major conspiracy to fall. It really could. I mean, I'm encouraged by the. It looks as if they're not able to keep all the fingers in the dike anymore with Diana,
so to speak. Now, I do feel as well that almost every single conspiracy that's going on right now is starting to come into the light. Have you noticed that? You know, it's like there's so many things that we never heard of that have been going on for like 50, 60 years that are now coming into full view. Things that have happened in living memory that were never suspected was a inside job or whatever that has now got the majority of the public thinking they were lied to. Right.
Yeah, that's very good. That's conspiratorial. That's people becoming aware of conspiracies in retrospect, which they didn't suspect at the time.
Exactly, and that's that is a very good sign.
It does. Yeah. Me too. I mean, a good example is Pearl Harbor, the various mistakes that were made, which led to the destruction of some very, very old and obsolete ships in Pearl Harbor. Which didn't. It's no one questioned at the time. Everyone was just so horrified and shocked. Now people are looking back and they're picking it apart. They're going through the old documents and they're saying they let their guard. They put the shield down deliberately to let the Japanese in.
Well, not only that, they even provoked the situation. I mean, what was it? The invasion of the Philippines, for example, by the Japanese. You know the reason why the Japanese invaded the Philippines?
It's because I think there was a trade embargo from the United States on oil, or it's to do with the war in China, the Japanese war in China, and they were actually trying to bleed Japan dry to provoke them.
They had an oil embargo on Japan. That's a declaration of war by any standards. And they had a hemp embargo because the Philippines at the time were massively used by the United States for growing hemp, for ropes and various other materials and so on and so forth, and they embargoed that as well. And that's why the Japanese invaded the Philippines, is to get their hands on the hemp plantations for the war effort. You know? And on top of that, Australian intelligence, if there is such a thing, reported that a massive Japanese attack fleet was heading towards Pearl Harbor, like a couple of days to a week, I think, before it actually got bombed. And the United States got the reports and sat on them until it was too late.
Yep, exactly. Right. And by coincidence, I mean, the ships that actually proved to be decisive, the weapons platforms that proved to be decisive in that war, were the submarine and the aircraft carrier. And coincidentally, those vessels were out on exercise at the time the Japanese planes attacked. The planes took down these huge battleships that were amazing to look at, these huge big gun battleships that were the symbol of American sea power. But it was very much a psychological statement, because those, by the time that World War II broke out, the big gun battleships were obsolete virtually, and all they did was basically did what a breaker's yard were going to do in probably in 5 years' time anyway. But it obviously killed 1,100 people and shocked the nation, shocked the world. And of course, President Roosevelt, who'd said he was absolutely determined not to get involved in war in Germany, he'd been steady edging that way. He wanted to, but he was doing it very, very craftily, you know, maybe allowing British forces to use the bases and things like that. But he needed a big coup to allow full declaration of war on Germany and Japan, and this was it. It was. I mean, George W. Bush called 9/11 our Pearl Harbor, and that was the original one.
Yeah. You just let it happen or do it yourself, because the end result is the same. Everybody feels really afraid, feels like they're under attack, and need their leader to save them, and they sign up, and they send the best, the brightest, the youngest, and most full of promise away to die.
Yeah. It's a big, it's a way of traumatizing.
They took out a whole generation, right? Yeah. I mean, think about this. Think about this. Who signs up to go to war when your country's under attack? Patriots, right? Good people, intelligent people, people with honor, common decency, respect, that kind of thing.
People who mean well.
No wonder society's the way it is now, because an entire generation of those people got exterminated.
Yeah, it's not just the physical damage a war does. It's the psychological damage, the emotional damage, on a cultural level. As well, which can, in the long run, can be even worse.
Yeah.
I mean, people are still traumatized over the war, you know, over the Second World War. Even the First World War has had an enormous impact on our culture in Britain and many other places.
Yeah. Well, we have Anzac Day every year here in New Zealand. And I remember Anzac Day as simply being the day that we remember all those soldiers who were lied to so that tyrannical governments could get away with whatever they wanted anyway and wind up saving a hell of a lot of money on debt paying back to criminal banks that financed both sides. We'll be right back.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick, give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary, yeah, give me a whiskey sour, yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back.
Hi, Vinny.
All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And it's our final segment here today with Ben Emlyn Jones. It's Emily Jones.
Emlyn.
Emlyn. Emlyn. Okay, Emlyn. What does Emlyn mean? Is it like emblem? Awesome.
Well, it's things about Wales. So I come from Wales, and in Wales there's so many Joneses they have to sort of like split us up. So most people, a lot of people have double names in Wales. So there's Emlyn Jones, Rhys Jones, and Gwyn Jones and things like that. And I'm Emlyn Jones.
So this is how the Welsh keep up with the Joneses?
Exactly, yes. I've got to keep up with mine.
Okay. Well, I would like to ask you, being in the UK, having seen the way things work, and actually worked in the hospital system, what do you feel is one of the greatest threats, not physically, but mentally, to the people of the United Kingdom? What are some of the greatest psyops type BS that's going on at the moment, to your knowledge?
Right, it's probably, well, off the top of my head, I'd say television propaganda is a big threat. It is a really, really major threat at the moment. We've got some absolutely appalling television programs which are loaded with various types of propaganda. I mean, there was one on Monday night called, it was called On Benefits and Proud. And I don't know if you can actually see it in your country, but there's a video available online. And it's basically, they follow these unemployed people around, these unemployed women who are big families and they're spending lots of money. They take big lots of cash out of the bank and they go around buying lots of food and they go to clothes shops. They get their nails done at manicurists and things like that. And their menfolk are very, very lazy. They're portrayed as very lazy. They're lying on couches all the time. In almost every shot, it seems like their husbands and boyfriends are lying on couches. And this program has suddenly come about just after the government has announced that they want to dismantle a lot of the welfare state. They want to bring in sort of reforms to the welfare, which means that people get less benefits. Unemployed people get less money. And what's more, they're expected also, lots of unemployed people are now expected to go on to unpaid civic labor schemes, which is basically, it's basically slavery. They have to work for no money. And, of course, anyone who's unemployed now, it's such a nightmare being unemployed in this country, especially today, that the government is going to have a hard job trying to justify it to the general public. And what they're doing is, because if you look at the government, of course, they have shares in these TV companies. They are executive producers of many of these programs. This is obviously an attempt to mold public opinion. And so that when the government comes out with some policy to keep the unemployment money down, you know, stuff like this, they'll go, oh, yeah, they won't be thinking of all the people out queuing up outside the job centre. They won't be thinking about all the people living off food stamps and, grocery boxes from the Red Cross. They'll be thinking about these welfare queens lying around with their overstuffed shopping bags, these sort of foul-mouthed, inarticulate, overweight women strutting around living the life of Riley. And it's false. It's a complete falsehood. The characters in this programme were complete freaks. It's extremely rare people live that kind of life when they're on the dole. Extremely rare indeed. So, really, I mean, it absolutely made my blood boil to watch this program, this waste of cathode rays. It really was a disgrace, and I've had a good rant about it on the Hospital Porters Against the New World Order blog recently. And that, I think, is one of the biggest threats we face.
Have you seen a British television show called The Aristocrats?
I haven't, no.
They did an episode on the Rothschild family.
Oh.
And they're portrayed as these very nice, well-to-do people who are working hard, struggling to keep their dynasty alive. Oh, we're Jewish, so we're outsiders, and so on and so forth. You're like, oh, you poor dear in your £7 billion mansion with about £50 billion worth of art in it. You poor dear. I mean, the unfortunates.
Oh, I know. I mean, just look at Victor Rothschild. I mean, I know he's pretty old, but there's no way he was ever starving to death in a concentration camp, was it? I mean, look at the man.
Yeah.
He's a fat, sweaty, creepy little guy. He's always talking about reducing the population as well and, you know, bringing in things to cap climate change and stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, well, speaking of the Rothschilds, I'm going to give big ups to We Are Change New York. They just really confronted one of the Lord Rothschilds, who just kind of like, when you talk about the New World Order, when you talk about the Rothschild banking cartel to these people, they don't admit it. What they do is they just smile at you,
yeah,
and then walk away.
Yes. I think I saw that. That was excellent.
is just kind of creepy, don't you think?
Very. Even that old, was Henry, they did Henry Kissinger once, and he said, "Go away now, I don't want to speak to you," or something like that. He did.
Yeah.
Basically, they squirm, and they try and wriggle, and they just, yeah, they very calmly, very coolly sort of like dismiss you and walk off.
It would be wonderful if everybody had the gall that we are changing. They are really, I feel, one of my main inspirations for starting to do what it is that I do. And I don't confront scumbags quite so much anymore. I'm spending all of my time promoting good people who are exposing the scumbags. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm playing middleman now instead of the frontline trooper. And it reminded me how exciting it is. Like, your heart's racing, your blood's pumping, because you know that you're about to ambush a criminal psychopath, right, with the truth.
Absolutely.
It's such a rush. And it's very scary at the same time. But after you ambush them and nothing happens other than them smile and walk away, it emboldens you and just think, hey, that wasn't that hard.
Yeah. I'll tell you what really gave me encouragement was the Bilderberg Fringe Conference, because the Bilderberg group met in Watford this last year. I'm sure you're aware that they had their big shindig at this big mansion in Watford in Hertfordshire, England. And, well, a few of us went along to sort of like get protest. Now, a few years ago, it was basically Jim Tucker and his dog. This time, 3,000 people turned up, and they were turning people away at the gate. Did you see the video? It's incredible. It was absolutely magnificent. There was Alex Jones there, David Icke, load of other people were there. A couple of the guys from We Are Change were there, and it was magnificent. It was a magnificent, uplifting event, and it really, really shows that this is the end of the beginning kind of thing, as David Icke said.
Yeah. I would love to be able to go outside and protest outside a Bilderberg conference. That would be like, oh, that's one of my main goals in life, to do the whole cameras in the tinted windows, scumbaggery bangster's face, telling them that they're scum and that they're evil, and I will expose their scumbaggery. It's just, oh yeah.
they may come down to your neck of the woods at some point, Vinny. I mean, they do sort of like travel around a bit, and they're running out of 5-star hotels with golf courses in Europe and North America. So they may decide to come down the Antipodean route, in which case you'd be very, very well positioned to intercept them.
You know, I think that might be a good idea. And also, that guy who confronted David Rockefeller in Chile, do you remember that? David Rockefeller being wheeled in his wheelchair.
Leave Chile! Leave Chile!
That was awesome.
God. There's still a lot of work to be done, because it was great that 3,000 people turned up, but I think 20,000 people turned up a couple of weeks later in Belfast, Northern Ireland, for the G20 or the G8 or whatever it's called now. It was adding new numbers onto it. Every time a country borrows so much money from the World Bank, it ceases to be in the third world. And obviously, I mean, the thing about the G20 is it's basically the public relations. It's the press conference for the Bilderberg group, basically.
Yeah.
And I think people have to realize, those protesters in Belfast have to realize where the real power is, and they have to move from Belfast to Watford. They should turn up there instead. And I think that's the task we have set ourselves now, making people aware of that.
What I've found is that socialist protesters and social justice kind of people, they're inherently against the same things that we're against, you know, corporate corruption, scumbaggery, and so on and so forth. Yet, they're the ones who call you an anti-Semite if you mention the Rothschilds. They're the ones who call you a conspiracy theorist if you mention international banking cartels.
I know. This is crazy. I mean, they're the ones who really go for you if you talk about 9/11 being an inside job and things like that. And
a friend of mine said 9/11 was an inside job, and one of these socialists called him anti-Semitic.
It's crazy, isn't it? They say, well, you think the Jews were phoned to stay, told to stay off. I said, oh, no, not that old chestnut again. I mean, it's over 300 Jews died that day, and I've met hardly anyone in the 9/11 truth movement who really believes all that nonsense about, as if Mossad would phone people up and tell them to stay off work if they wanted to do a hit. No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't leave a red flag like that. They just go in and do it and let them die. It's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. But I think this point is amplified by people who don't like us to make us look like nasty anti-Semitic Nazis and things like that. Which
accuse you of being racist, you know. It's like that was another thing. I remember I was having we're about to end the show now. I've got about 45 seconds. But anyway, we're talking with this woman who kind of produces television here in New Zealand, and she was trying to recruit me to work for her, you know, doing my video stuff and doing what I normally do. And we talked about Obama and how he was a big pawn of the banksters, and she's to us, you know, claiming that she knows about the New World Order and all of that kind of stuff, and she says to us, oh, anybody who criticizes Obama is racist.
Oh, please. Oh, dearie me. This is why Obama is such a good tool. He's such a good pawn, because he has this...
We've only got 10 seconds. Please plug your websites, and then we've got to go.
Hpanwo, H-P-A-N-W-O, Hospital Porters Against the New World Order. Come over there, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Critical Cheers, Mass Vinny. Radio as well.
Yeah, that one too. Cheers.